Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I remember very distinctly quite a number of years ago, well over a decade, when the World Wide Web was, actually it was probably more like 15 years ago, when the World Wide Web was, you know, already established, kicking in, but still hadn't quite achieved the sort of saturation levels that we live with now in terms of the general penetration of the internet into our lives and minds. And my friend Carlos Seligo talked about the fascinating relationship in nature that between the sort of the flower, let's say, and the wasp or bee, and this very strange kind of symbiotic relationship where these two very different creatures have this completely codependent relationship, and how, from the perspective of the insect, you know, it's a pretty good deal. You just cruise around, and there's all these delicious flowers, many different kinds, and they're just open. You walk right in, have some tasty food, check it out, enjoy the scents and smells, and take off again for another flower. And, you know, it seems to be pretty good. But, of course, at the same time, you are also doing the flower's business in a way that you're probably not even aware of. That is carrying the pollen, et cetera, allowing the reproduction of the plants to go forward through the mediation of all this yummy free stuff. And he said, you know, that's exactly what's going on with the World Wide Web. Everybody thinks it's this great utopia of free information, of a post-consumer society where everyone can, you know, enjoy the fruits of knowledge and creativity and share it freely. But of course, in the meantime, you're doing the system's business in leaving crumbs of data everywhere you go. And now we know, of course, just how far you can go with using that data to produce, you know, I remember back when people were saying, well, yeah, but they'll never be able to track you individually. It's only large statistical formations of data. And it's like, well, no, actually, that's not true at all. So there's any number of ways in which the breadcrumbs of data and metadata that we leave as we cruise through a digital space are used to create profiles, to create statistical patterns useful for business, for government, for all manner of surveillance. And one of the things this does is that it produces a kind of uncanny creepiness to data interaction, at least for some of us who are tuned into this wasp flower, wasp orchid model, where it feels like what is, on the one hand, a wonderful opportunity to share information, to learn information, to get a free download, to, you know, discover some curious event, is always shadowed by this kind of invisible regime of capture, data collection, and increasingly the production of new kinds of knowledge based on that data. Because, of course, a lot of what the sort of hot wave of artificial intelligence that we hear about now is about is precisely about figuring out ways to extract meaningful data and patterns and analysis from this increasing tsunami of data that clogs, or, you know, like, you know, like a fecund sort of waterfall spills out of our digital devices and digital networks. And, you know, again, for some of us, this is a profound source of concern, and we begin to try to figure out what we can learn about what's going on with surveillance, with our data traces. And at the same time, most people seem to kind of happily move forward. And that itself is kind of an interesting political problem, leaving aside the revelations of Edward Snowden and the NSA and all the forms of data surveillance that Google is using and all the things that are coming down the pike. There's a fundamental split, I think, between, in a lot of people's lives, between those of us who find this deeply upsetting and unnerving, particularly in terms of its future potentials, and people who just kind of go with it. You know, they either get too much out of the deal to bother with it, or they kind of trust the system, or they think, well, this is just what's happening, so let's just stop worrying about it. And as one of the worriers, it can sometimes be sort of extra alienating, not only that I'm immersed in the situation, but that if I start to talk about it very much with a lot of people, they give you kind of a glazed eye, like, you're still stuck with that issue? Like, haven't you just, you know, let go, man, and ride the wave? But some of us cannot let go, including our guest today, a great old friend of mine, Andrew Holt-Krantz. I met Andrew in the 1990s, and he's been doing very interesting stuff then and now. He worked for Monda 2000 back in the day, in the early 90s, when that crazy magazine was sort of mapping out the strange intersections of counterculture, new technology, psychedelics, weird mysticism, and political critique. He went on to edit Book Forum, a book review magazine that I've occasionally contributed to myself. And he wrote a super nifty book in the 33 and a third series of books about rock records. He wrote the second one on Forever Changes, and reading that book and talking to Andrew inspired me to pitch my own contribution to the series, which I think was the 17th or 18th, the one on Led Zeppelin 4. So you have Andrew to blame for that bit of amusement. Anyway, the main reason that we're talking to him today is that he's been researching the surveillance implications of big data for over a decade now on for a book project, very much hope that sees the light of day before too long. And in the meantime, we get to talk to Andrew about it. So, Andrew, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Of course. Thanks, Eric.
So, you know, we were, you know, talking beforehand about how to approach this hazy topic. And one of the things I really appreciate about your story, the way in which you create a story about all of these confusing, overwhelming, somewhat conspiratorial, sometimes hard to wrap your head around issues, is by putting it into a larger narrative about American history and American, let's call it, ideology, one that you trace back to the Puritans. And, you know, in a way, it's a hackneyed thing to say about America. You can't really understand America unless you understand the Puritans. And in a way, it sort of seems alien today because very few people in the United States, even few Christians, are particularly Puritan, at least in the classic sense. So it seems like, well, maybe it was important back then, but it doesn't really make a difference. But no. In many ways, the Puritan mind frame undergirds American society as well as capitalism itself. So I know you start there, and then you do some very interesting things with the implications of this tradition. So let's just start out there and talk a little bit about the Puritan mind frame and what it was about their theology and their attitude towards the world that kind of sets up what we'll see as some profound implications in terms of contemporary surveillance practices.
Sure. Well, as you know, the American Puritans were what you call late Calvinists. That was a certain Calvinism, was a certain branch of Protestantism that was, quite extreme, kind of posited an extremely remote and uncaring God who had sorted everything out long before anybody was born, long before the word was created, and that everything was set in stone. And you basically, even as a good Christian, as a good Calvinist, you couldn't really change anything about that. So they believed in a concept of what they call predestination, which has to do with your afterlife status. Either you're going to heaven or you're going to hell. Now, in most Christian denominations, there's some kind of avenue, if you are a sinner, which we all are, of course, according to that, from day one, that you can actually kind of, make good or redeem your sins by, deciding to give yourself to Christ, etc., doing good works, living a good life. And then God will observe this and say, hey, you know, Andrew's really turned his life around. Let's get him into heaven. Whereas in Calvinism, based on the premise that God is extremely omniscient, like the most omniscient you can think of, that it's impossible to conceive of the fact that God couldn't have known everything that was going to happen for eons into the future. So, of course, he already knows everybody's going to be born and everybody's going to be either saved or damned and they're going to end up in heaven or hell. And so they believe in this very grim fatalism about their afterlife status, about their future after death.
You know, I just interrupt one thing to maybe this will help clarify something I read relatively recently that helped explain this view, because you hear this and you go, God, that's just so bizarre. How could that come about? And what this one guy's take was that this late Calvinism is occurring, you know, during the rise of what we would now think of as science, when society is shifting from a kind of medieval worldview into the modern view of science and capitalism, and particularly the ability of people to explain formerly bizarre or enchanted aspects of nature using causal logic. You know, it's like, no, actually, it's just a series of causes. We can identify them. We can use our reasons to explain the world. Right. And that part of this reaction was a way to kind of, on the one hand, acknowledge this world of determinism, this world of like that scientific laws say that things are going to happen one way or the other. There's nothing we can do about it. And allow to affirm that while at the same time keeping a little place for God. So God had to get more and more remote, didn't care about you, far away, isn't going to make your day better. We're out of that one. But he's still there, ultimately running the show behind this new network of causes that at that time, in particular with the rise of mechanism, the idea that nature is a kind of machine, a kind of clockwork mechanism, the idea was that everything is pretty much determined, but God's still in the picture. So it helped me a little bit understand why this very strange to us idea could make a lot of sense at a particular point in history. But
right.
Go on.
Well, in their view, God will have determined all of the causes that humans are figuring out as scientists.
Exactly.
So yes, he's the ultimate scientist in some ways. He's discovered everything because he was aware of everything, and he's set everything into stone before the whole ball game begins, so to speak. And so hence predestination. And of course, another thing that Calvin taught and the Puritan ministers of the time taught was that your afterlife status was unknowable, meaning, of course, one would want to look for signs of whether you were saved or damned if you really believed this. But because God was so remote and so inconceivable to the puny human mind, there was no way that we could either see signs, or even if we could see signs in nature or in our lives, that we couldn't interpret them correctly. They were told, basically, look, this is the deal. You're going to heaven. You're either saved or damned. There's nothing you can do about it. But by the way, don't try to figure out whether or not you're saved or damned, because you just couldn't possibly do it. Now, of course, if you put yourself in the American Puritan mindset, and if you actually really, truly believed in this system, nothing would be more important to you than discovering what your status would be. It creates this kind of weird, you know, undercurrent of anxiety throughout your whole life that you're looking to somehow end or fulfill or, you know, modify. And the only way one could do that was to try to convince yourself and to convince others that you were indeed saved. And ultimately, as Max Weber argued, I think persuasively, and others have built on, that anxiety about one's future status and the fact that you couldn't know it while you were alive led to a certain kind of anxious busyness, a kind of, you know, extreme industry and activity in order to become successful in a material sense in the world, to sort of prove to your neighbors and most importantly to yourself that you were indeed saved. And Weber, of course, attributes this to the foundations of modern capitalism, certainly American capitalism. And I essentially agree with him on that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the aspects of that's also interesting is that the capitalist was also the sort of figure in society that was using new sciences and new technologies and the sort of creativity released by mechanism, by the idea that you could understand the mechanisms of things in order to create new values. So it was also kind of appropriate, that sort of deterministic way of thinking, fatalistic way of thinking of the world. You could also then go, well, yes, but we do know how these things work, so let's exploit them. You know, so it all fit in this really beautiful way. And that, it's funny, that book by Max Weber, I mean, it's you know over a century old, and it's still just such an amazing insight into the kind of underpinnings of our world. On the surface, it looks like we're no longer Puritans. We're hedonists. We're consumers. We just enjoy things. We like entertainment. We like advertising. There's this kind of hedonism to American culture, and indeed to capitalist culture. You know, talk to Muslims about that. But beneath it, the engine of it, and that's what's more important, is the engine of it, which is also the place where we're going to see these surveillance mechanisms and these control mechanisms. The element of control and the system itself is still running, I think, on a much more Puritan logic.
Yeah, well, I agree that the asceticism, I think you're identifying, of Puritan culture is no longer really present, other than perhaps the most fundamental evangelicals. But this status anxiety thing is really particular to America and does continue to obtain. And I want to add something to the status anxiety thing, which is, it's not only the late Calvinism and the belief in predestination that created this anxiety. It's also because they had left a country, a society, a continent in which there was royalty and aristocracy, meaning everybody basically knew who they were. They knew their place. There was a king, there were earls and dukes, there were blah, blah, blah. And if you were a peasant, you were a peasant. There's no way you were going to become an earl or duke, right? So you basically, even if your lot was terrible, you kind of accepted in the back of your head there was no real mobility. There's nothing you could do about it. So in some ways, that produces some kind of comfort, however cruel or unsatisfactory. Whereas if you both believe you don't know where you're going after death, and you don't know really where you fit in a new society, meaning there are no kings, dukes, earls, etc., then you're also going to be extra concerned about how do you rank next to your neighbors, next to the rest of your community. And again, this also produces a kind of anxiety to be busy, to succeed in a material sense, to have a successful business or farm or whatever, because you want to be the kind of virtual duke or earl of your community, right? You don't actually want to have that title, but you want to be regarded as one of the upper people, you know, one of the upper crustaceans.
Yeah. I just want to mention to people that I know you haven't seen this film, but if folks haven't seen the film The Witch, the sort of New England Puritan horror movie, I highly recommend it. It's a very intelligent movie, and they understand Puritanism very well. But in that film, you'll see, in a way, a lot of the elements that Andrew's been talking about, particularly this last bit where the family, they're ostracized even from the little community that's already detached itself from Europe, and so they go out in the wilderness all alone, just the group of them, and they're extremely anxious about the status. And one of the things that the father does a lot is that he's chopping wood all the time. Like, he's got way more wood than he needs. He's like, the only time he feels okay is when he's chopping wood.
Right.
And it's that same sense of busyness, of anxiety, which then the film takes on this kind of supernatural character. But talk about status anxiety today.
Well, I mean, you can go to social media almost immediately. And of course, you know, one of the first things and the first big social media platforms was, you know, relationship status. You know, are you single or are you in a relationship? But of course, all news on Facebook or social media feed from your friends or likes, how many likes this or that post you've posted get. Those are all elements of status. How many friends you have on Facebook, how many likes you get, et cetera. These are all sort of products of this kind of need to force rank oneself in the community and say, look, I've got so many more friends and so many more likes than my other friend, and therefore I feel better, you know. And as we were discussing earlier offline, if you are our age and you have kind of one foot in this stuff and one foot out, meaning, we're, you know, both of us, I think, are totally love the internet and are okay with the internet. In principle, I think, you know, where we divide with some younger people perhaps is in some of the effects of social media. You know, that we notice these things very much, meaning we notice the kind of the extra busy checking of one's latest updates to one's Facebook page or whatever, to be this similar kind of constant activity to discover, divine, and prove one's status to oneself, because one never really knows, do one, what one's status is in America.
I remember one time I was, when I first sort of got on Twitter, and I was, or you know, and I was checking, and I always sort of resisted finding numbers just because that's my kind of in you know, sort of perversity in our contemporary world. Like, I didn't really want to know how many people are checking my site and this and that. Yeah. And then at one point, I was noticed in myself that I was getting a little obsessed about the numbers. I saw that I had this many followers or whatever, mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh God, I'm kind of bummed out. And then what am I going to do about this? And oh geez, I should really do more stuff to get more numbers. And then I had this like little beautiful thought experiment, which was, I went, wait a second. Many people who I have absolutely no respect for, who are horrible writers, terrible speakers, putting out awful material that should be expunged from the, from, you know, human society, if there was any justice, have millions of followers.
Yeah.
There's no way. And I'm like, as soon as I went there, I went, oh, I realized that actually the numbers don't matter unless I have some, you know, pure quantification that's going to make me money. I mean, in any kind of psychological sense, it's meaningless, like absolutely meaningless. And so for me, it kind of cured me of that practice. I mean, whatever, I can sort of get away with that because of the conditions in my life. Other people, maybe they depend on it more. They need it, that quantification for their gig or whatever they're doing. But outside of these very concrete, pragmatic levels, you know, it's a lost cause. I mean, it's a bad game to get into.
Well, I mean, it's purely kind of an ego vanity thing, really. I mean, the as you say, there could be some, you know, financial reward to having more friends on Facebook, but generally it's mostly about ego satisfaction and vanity. And again, kind of saying, you know, demonstrating to yourself and to others, like your other friends on Facebook, that you are more popular than they are, that you have a higher status than they do in some ways. And it's not like you're even kind of, you know, cruelly lording it over them. It's just, this is an operation that sort of goes on in the back of one's head without full consciousness, I think.
I mean, yeah, it always reminded me a bit of high school. Like there was something, it felt like the social media sort of got to the high school level. Mm-hmm. And obviously it has all these other effects, and it's how people find out. I mean, I'm not on Facebook, and I there's like a void in my social life where information used to be. You know, like I miss parties. I don't find out when people are coming to town. There's this kind of present absence in my life that's a bit distressing. We can talk more about that, later, but it's just that, you're kind of locked in. You have no sort of way of navigating it outside of this, framework, but it still sort of seems like on a psychological level, it got to a point where like whatever fuels high school rivalries and as the establishment of identity, mm-hmm. It's like we're still there, and I keep waiting for it to get to, like, you know, graduate school or something. Maybe that wouldn't be any better, but it would be at least some kind of evolution.
I agree. I mean, part of the problem, of course, is that, you know, even though the internet is full of images and text and all sorts of things, it's all really based on quantification. It records everything. It ranks everything. So in some ways, it is the insertion of quantification values that are kind of intruding upon human values, meaning people who are not, as you say, didn't used to look at the numbers, suddenly feel like, you, oh God, maybe I should look at my numbers, how many friends I have or whatever. And it's just because the system is set up that way, and it's sort of bleeding into our consciousness and making us care about things like raw numbers. And you know, you can transfer this to the popist field of music criticism, where, you know, sales are aesthetic greatness, meaning, you know, the thing that sells the most is the best. Forget about aesthetics or difficulty or art or whatever. I mean, I'm simplifying, but that's
what it boils down to, really.
No, no, I think it's really true. I remember, just to keep chatting on this topic, and then we'll move on, is I use MailChimp for an occasional, mail out to whatever, you know, a 1,000 people or something like that. And it's, you know, it's, when people unsubscribed, it tells you who they are. And I'm like, I don't want to know that. You know, maybe I don't even really want to see the number, but I mean, I guess I'll see the number, but I don't want to know that that person said no more Eric Davis. It's like, it's almost obscene. It's like, I don't want to know that, you know? And so the kind of world where that is just like what you know to keep going and keep fueling it is very peculiar to me, but I'll stop kvetching here. And what I want to do is ask you to link this notion of status.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we're quantifying all of our behavior through data that can be surveyed and organized,
yep.
And how that sets up what a possible future of surveillance. I mean, you talk about how the way we typically think about surveillance is our past is recorded and then maybe used against us. So we find out, you know, the cops knocking the door. Oh, actually, we were surveilling you, and
right. You
met up with this guy, or you had an affair, or whatever the thing is. And so we're used to that kind of idea of surveillance surveys the past and mm-hmm. might use the past against me for some current kind of issue. But your view is that this is what we're actually seeing is the beginnings of a very different relationship between time and surveillance. And it has to do with this kind of status stuff. So,
yeah. Well, absolutely. Let me also clarify that when I'm talking about this stuff, what we're really talking about a subset of surveillance, which is obviously an enormous growth area of surveillance and probably will be the biggest element of surveillance ultimately. But it's used to be called data valence, which I think is a very inelegant term, but the term big data was floated a few years ago, not by surveillance activists, but by people who are positivists and businessmen and who are into this stuff, and some sociologists, I'm sure, too, and medical people. But big data always struck me as a kind of super creepy term, because while you know, we use usually big, capital big blank as a pejorative, like big pharma or big tobacco. In this case, it's being put forward as a kind of like a cuddly kind of big brother, kind of, and not like the Orwell big brother, because it's kind of like a thing that's kind of taking care of us and embracing us. You know, we are constituting it by filling it with our data, but then it's coming back and blessing us with, you know, great insights into disease control or whatever. And I'm not saying that those insights will not exist. There are good elements of big data, but what we're talking about here is the surveillance aspects of big data and not video cameras, wiretaps, satellites, et cetera. Right.
Right.
So in terms of the tense, I call it, of surveillance and how it's changed, and data valence, it basically has gone from what you just said, recording past events, say a video cam in a store or warehouse, to be able to arrest and prosecute people in the present, to a kind of situation where profiles are developed by the data that you put into the system, i.e. by using the internet or any technological wired devices, and they create profiles. And I'm not saying there's one master profile. There's no longer kind of a Frank Zappa central scrutinizer or a Orwellian big brother. Each company or government agency you interact with through these methods are taking your data and developing profiles of you for a variety of reasons, depending on whether it's private sector or government. But the whole idea is basically to get a better idea of who you are, to be able to slot you into certain categories, and then from that to be able to say, okay, this category of person usually does this and does not do that, and so we'll offer him or deny him this or that because it's outside of his profile. It's no longer going to be a binary status like saved or damned, right? Going to heaven or going to hell. It's going to be many, many, many micro kind of statuses, which each have their own kind of track of opportunities and everything else.
Are there good examples of, like, I mean, one of the ways that, of course, this makes me think of is Philip K. Dick and Minority Report, you know, as an example of, like, And one of the places we see these kinds of predictive profiles happening is in crime. And yeah. So there are certain kind of, you know, and since we have this data, you can actually discover that there are correlations. You know, if people are this old and they live in this area and yep. they have this kind of income, they're more likely to do X or Y. And so that kind of information is starting to become part of how the police do their work. And so, you know, you take it to the extreme and you look at something like the short story and the film Minority Report and the short story it was based on, where you have this idea of pre-crime, which when Philip K. Dick wrote that story, you read it and it was like totally wacky sci-fi. It was just like anything else. And now it's just not wacky sci-fi. It's got some real. So what I, either if you could maybe flesh that policing use of big data more, or maybe another example to give us a kind of concrete sense of how it's changing the tense or the time frame or the relationship to time.
You can imagine most large corporations at this point and most law enforcement or intelligence government agencies to be like insurance companies in the old day. Now, you know, insurance was the old pre-internet business model, which I think the big data era draws on the most, which is to say, you know, actuarial tables using statistics and probability to try to figure out how long a person was going to live or how risky their lives were and whether or not they were likely to get hit by a truck at the workplace or whatever, and hence, you know, set life insurance or health insurance premiums. So if you imagine the cops doing this, they are basically, you know, they have all kinds of databases, the gang databases and whatnot, that they put people in based on, you know, certain interactions in the field by the police. The police find some kid who seems to be friends with some known gang members, and he has some minor, you know, misdemeanor altercation with the kid. But he puts them into the database, and he also says, you know, associate of you know, the 192 Piru Bloods or something. And even if that kid is not actually a gang member, then suddenly he's got these associations. And if there's an order to like sweep up all the Piru Bloods, this kid will be arrested along with the other known ones because he's gotten on this database. And, you know, it's very much a garbage in, garbage out kind of scenario. As with all data issues and all databases, many, many things get put into your profiles of all sorts, which are inferences or weak associations or perhaps assumptions, but they end up getting kind of set in stone because these, you know, both corporations and the government are very bad about going back into their databases and sort of double checking and cleansing the data. So as this stuff becomes more and more important, and as it becomes more and more automated, which is another key point of this, meaning it's machines making the decisions as to what profile you go into and to what that profile can access or should be denied, then you've got a real problem of accountability, of remedies, of being able to correct your data. Like if you look at EU data protection laws, which are personal data protection laws, which are much stronger than America's, actually most of the world's are stronger than America's, one thing they're really concerned about is both data control, which is like who actually has your personal data, but they're also really concerned with your ability to be able to correct your data if you become aware that there's some incorrect aspect to it that's creating problems for you. And it's a bureaucratic nightmare, and it's kind of an almost unenforceable ideal, but it is getting to one of the main issues here, which is that there's really no accountability for the organizations, private or public, which are taking in the data, creating profiles, creating predictions based on those profiles to actually go back and say, hey, you know, maybe this bit of information about Andrew was incorrect. They almost will never do that. And in America, there's basically hardly any recourse to do that legally, both either for corporations or for the government. Minority Report is sort of like that too. It becomes like they're relying on the precogs, and precogs are mutant humans, right? But they're attached to this big computer rig, which is parsing their visions and turning them into actionable predictions. But they are like, you know, in some ways it's an automated system that's shown in Minority Report, even though it involves some biological elements, right? It's the ball gets inscribed and rolls out, and that the cops go out and arrest that person, right?
That's the part where the predestination thing really starts kicking in, is the way that not just in this particular domain of you know, sort of predictive policing, but just in so many ways, it's the algorithms that are taking in they're looking at the big data, they're mm-hmm. finding patterns. The patterns seem to be robust, and even though human beings don't understand why the pattern is there,
right.
The fact that the pattern is there is enough to make it operational, and right. increasingly the operational character, the way in which it's manifest in the world, is itself automated. So it's like the old place for scientific understanding is really disappearing. It's really important for people to understand this, because I mean, like, I talked to a PhD guy who runs a robotics lab, mm-hmm. and we were talking about this very issue, and he goes, yeah, you know, it's really creates a kind of a crisis for us who are, you know, handing out these PhDs, because we see you know, theses, you know, dissertations that are coming in, the kind of research that people are doing for their PhD, and they set up these very clever ways of extracting information, but there's nowhere where they explain why the patterns are what they are. It just shows that you can do this. And they're like, why did they get a PhD? I mean, it's not like they really understood anything. So, I mean, it's quite a pervasive sea change that's happening here in terms of algorithms, data, yeah. and actionable, operations.
The other thing to be aware of here is that we're reaching a point where, and this is going to be true of genetics as well, where there will be stuff we can do technologically in you know, data mining and predictive analytics. The stuff we'll be able to, you know, we will be able to predict the future within a reasonable percentage of accuracy, and it'll be a percentage that will convince many reasonable people, including data scientists, that, hey, you know, we should act on these predictions. And it may only be, you know, 85% accuracy, or maybe even less, but certainly more than 50%. But because we are kind of creating this machine, so to speak, broadly stated, and it's developing its own imperatives and appetites. And I don't mean as in an AI sense, but just it's kind of Foucauldian sense, right? Like the system creates its own power dynamics and its own needs, which then the humans that even created it have to serve. But it's never going to be 100% accurate, but people are going to accept that it's accurate enough. And that's really kind of the dangerous thing. Like, what happens to the other 15% who get falsely implicated or get arrested or get, some privileges denied from them because of some mistaken prediction based on a data profile?
Yeah, it could be a terrifying experience, man. I had a weird one. I think it was in 2006. I was in Costa Rica at a conference, and I got back on the plane with my wife and a bunch mm-hmm. of friends. And I was sitting on the plane. They called me to the Then they, all right, Davis, you know, come to the door. Yeah. So I went to the door to the gangway, and there are these two dudes, did not identify themselves, plain clothes. They were clearly holding me. They didn't really explain why. They didn't speak English very well. And then one of them asked me my mother's maiden name. mm-hmm. And I was hesitant about giving them this information, but I figured that all things considered, I really wanted to get out of that situation. And so yep. I gave them, and then they made a call. They spoke in Spanish. I didn't understand what they were saying. And then they let me back on the plane. And whatever that was, you know, I had plenty to feast on with my own little tendencies towards to paranoia and suspicion of authorities. It was just a tiny little drop of mm-hmm. the kinds of, you know, random, coercive, authoritarian screw-ups and nightmares that happen to people, you know, all the time. And that what I think the fear here is that it just, as it gets more and more robust and as it gets more and more installed into actual technological systems, yep. and as human beings get more and more used to just saying, well, yeah, that's what the machine says. There's a pattern yep. there. We got to act on it. That yep. the potential for abuse, even unintentional abuse, almost right. more than intentional abuse, grows ever greater.
Yeah, I mean, two things about that. First of all, you should be aware that I'll add another wrinkle to whatever paranoia that Costa Rican stop engendered, but mother's maiden name is probably one of the top five identity theft bits of data, meaning name, address, date of birth, social security number, mother's maiden name is usually like the fourth or fifth one in that. So I'm not saying these guys were part of a identity theft ring. Obviously, they were authorities of some sort, but it's interesting that they use that, or they ask for that data point, because it is something that a fisher, an information fisher, would ask for in some underhanded way to create a, you know, a fake ID profile of somebody else. But the other thing is, to your point about the automation, imagine if those guys were robots, or imagine like a traffic stop where you're pulled over for speeding, and the cop, instead of being a human cop, is a robot cop, right? The robot cop has prime directives and rules and everything else, and it's inflexible. It's a machine. So there may be a situation where you're speeding because, you know, you've got a sick kid in the back, because, you know, one of your relatives is in trouble somewhere across town and it's an emergency. And if it was a human cop, you could explain this to them and they would probably let you off. They would just tell you to be more careful. But there, you know, there'd be a flexibility and a kind of context-based judgment that a human cop could make that a robot cop would not make, right? And so the automation just, you know, it creates these kind of situations where there's just no recourse. There's no give, there's no bend. And if you're screwed over by an error by one of these machines, there's no real remedy for that.
You know, and another dimension of this that you talk about is the way it locks people. It returns to a certain kind of caste system.
Yeah, caste. Although, one thing I should point out is that it amuses me. You know, Netflix streaming video. You know how they have like a gazillion super micro genre names, like,
yeah,
you know, strong female lead thriller, dark thriller with intelligence and happy ending, right? I mean, ridiculous kind of micro genres that basically only a handful of movies could easily slot into. Those are the kind of, when I talk about casts or micro casts in this respect, that's the kind of thing I'm referring to, meaning it's not going to be like four major avenues or five major avenues. It's going to be many, many, many ones, right? And they'll become more and more hyper-specific.
But the idea is, though, as we, you know, just based already at our, when we're kids and the kind of environment we grow up into and some of our early test scores or whatever it is, that the predictive window of what our lives are like becomes defined early on in a kind of narrowing way that in turn then allows and disallows other options down the road, so that the kind of, you know, I mean, if you just think about it, like economically, the way that the United States right now, there's so little variation between levels of income, despite our great myth of, you know, Horatio Alger and all that, that actually where people are very much locked into the, at least the class that they are born into for the most part, that kind of thing, you know, even the way that we understand how recommendations work on Amazon, et cetera, we already have a sense of that kind of, oh, you're kind of like this, you're going to like this,
right?
That the way in which that gets hardwired, so to speak, into the options and the kind of opportunities that people get as they go through life.
Yeah. I mean, the other issue there is that the kind of the logic of the data collection will ultimately demand that the collection of data goes earlier and earlier in one's life and even beyond the beginning of one's life, i.e. to your parents' lives, your grandparents' lives. The more sophisticated the profiling gets, the bigger sort of data sample it will want, right? But that also means that it increases the fatalism, meaning if your parents or your grandparents, one of them was a criminal or one of them got a terrible, perhaps infectious disease at some point in life, or were susceptible to such things, that would become part of your profile and say, well, you know, Eric has a 25% chance of becoming a criminal or getting this terrible disease, and so we will cordon him off from certain kinds of opportunities or certain kinds of communities. You know, at this point, we understand it as, you know, something like your credit history, right? Like all that matters is the stuff that you've done as an adult with your credit card or with bills and with payments. But with these more overarching kind of life profiles, it's going to take in all kinds of other information, which will include genetic information and will lead the system to want to drill down beyond the womb, basically, like, you know, your ancestors. So it creates an even more, you know, another track that's even harder to fix, because you can't do anything about how you can't remedy how your parents behaved or how your grandparents behaved.
Right. Now, I want to sort of ask you, maybe let's say we have about, you know, 10, 12 minutes left here. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you know, there's so many different ways, so many different opportunities people have to monitor themselves, you know, with like biometrics, you know, the Fitbit or new forms of the Nest and ways of making the energy use in your home more efficient by having data streams that are going to central servers, There's all these sort of opportunities, some of which obviously lead in some ways to very beneficial local effects. And for a lot of people, again, the knowledge that they, or at least the sort of knowledge that these things are also tracking them and creating records that can be used against him. We've seen examples of Fitbit data used in court cases, et cetera, et cetera. There's this weird, like, you know, again, just to speak personally, when I encounter those things now, I immediately just go, oh, this is just another opportunity to data survey me, you know, and it creates this fundamental inability to really get that excited about the other benefits of these actions. Clearly, that's not happening to most people. Some of them it's because they're ignorant. So it's because they have a different view of the value of this. They trust the system, or they make a calculation that the benefits outweigh the detracting factors. I think a lot of times that people are actually just kind of sweeping it under the carpet, like they know that there's something, they sense that there's something very disturbing about this, but they don't want to deal with it. Their imagination doesn't go there. They're not the kind of people who, they don't want to think of themselves as paranoids or whatever. And, you know, I know that by you've been working on this stuff for a decade. I'm sure there's been some dark days produced from it, whether you're, you know, just the knowledge of what's going on or how your knowledge of this information or your speculative aspect as well as your concrete contemporary awareness of what's going on, you know, kind of alienates you from people around you, even your friends, where you're looking at something that I think a lot of people just don't want to look at. And so almost on a more personal level, I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit about, like, what allows you to do this? What's the trap in it? When did you go too far? How do you balance the kind of alienation with the need to know and the ethics of the ethical drive that you have to understand and think about these very difficult and disturbing things in the midst of, you know, everybody else's celebration of the new data devices? Yep. You know, I'd love to hear a little bit about that side of this research for you.
Sure. Well, let me just quickly say something about the kind of double-mindedness that this engenders in a lot of people if they're thinking about the issues at all, and the kind of, you know, the reasons why they want to psychologically put it in the back of their heads or sweep it under the carpet is there was something, some Columbia journalism professor after the Snowden revelations, a couple of months afterwards, can't remember the guy's name, but he put out some article that was called, like, the Snowden Effect or something like that, and it was the Snowden Effect he defined as this weird kind of double-mindedness where, you know, you are an average American citizen, young, perhaps a young person who has an iPhone and uses all social media and is really into it. And then the Snowden revelations come out and, you know, you're technologically savvy enough to understand what Snowden was revealing and how it would apply to what you use technologically. But you're just, as you were saying earlier, like, there are just way too many upsides, and you've been completely habituated to having this iPhone and the social media stuff. So it creates this, you know, this horrible contradiction in your head, which you would do anything to get rid of, which is usually means you put it in the back of your head and forget about it, right? So yes, I occasionally have felt, particularly pre-Snowden, when I was working on this stuff and talking about it to friends and colleagues, that I was kind of like taking somebody's face and just rubbing it into, you know, shit, so to speak, and be like, you know, you think your life is good. Well, here, consider this stuff. it's also like with social media and with younger people, I felt a bit, and I still feel a bit like, you know, I'm scolding kids for, you know, saying like, you know, candy's not good all the time, kids, you know, you got to eat other things. There's a certain, you know, one, you'd have to try to avoid a certain kind of paternalism on these issues, particularly with young people. But that's, you know, that's how I instinctively see it, which is like, it's candy and I understand why it's attractive and it's hard to tell people who like candy that they should stop eating candy. Right. And so to get back to the arc of my book project and the personal aspects, I mean, you know, I left Book Forum in 2005. I wrote the Forever Changes book in the following year. And even during the Forever Changes time, I was already starting to get into this topic. I mean, I was interested in this topic long before I thought I could write a book about it. It probably goes back to when asked, I had to think about this, but I think I determined that the spark of interest came from my first viewing of the film Blade Runner. Like, if you know the initial interrogation scene with Leon, the first replicant, and the other Blade Runner, not Harrison Ford, who's got the void comp machine, which is kind of like a biometric lie detector machine. Right? It's focused on Leon's iris to detect lies or whatever. But the questions are a series of ethical questions. Like, you come upon a tortoise on its back in the desert. If you don't turn it over, it's going to die. What do you do? Right? So they're trying to tease out empathy and just human reactions to things. And there was something about the combination of the ethical questions, the machine that was reading biometrics in order to determine whether or not somebody was being truthful or not, that, you know, it was many years afterwards that I started thinking about data valence and whatever. But when I was asked this question so many times that, you know, I thought about it hard, and I think that was the beginning of it. And so, you know, obviously working on this stuff, the more you know about it, the more dispiriting it is. I mean, the more you know about it, the more small you feel, the more ineffectual you feel. Like, if you really want to feel incredibly powerless, read the terms of service for Google or Apple or Facebook, and realize that you are just, not necessarily you, but most people are just pushing that I agree button. And they're not reading it at all. But if they did read it and they knew legalese and they didn't understand it, they would never agree to it. They're the most rapacious terms you could possibly imagine, right?
Well, so, especially all that arbitration stuff where in the back of your mind, yeah, you feel like, well, no, but if something really bad goes happen, I can sue them. And it's like, you're like, nope, no, you can't even do that.
No. Yeah, no, it's really bad. So anyway, to answer your question, you know, I was researching it for a number of years. I was writing some articles about it. And I was really into it in the sense that I was really into both, you know, diving deeper into the Puritan Calvinist predestination argument and making, you know, to me it was almost as much an American intellectual history book idea as much as a kind of newsy political book. It would have had a newsy political element, but to me it was very much about you know, American ideology and Americans' peculiar and paradoxical relationship to freedom, in the sense that we are the land of the free, the home of the brave, but we are very, as you're seeing today in the era of terrorism, we are incredibly quick to give up our freedom. And literally, we've sort of gutted a lot of the Bill of Rights within 15 years of 9/11. It's been, you know, lots of people have howled in the media about it and whatever, but those are the facts. 15 years, you know, after 200 whatever years of this fairly novel and pretty great constitutional document, we're gutting it because we were attacked once on our soil. You know, it's horrible. 3,000 people died. I was here in New York when it happened. I know it's horrible. I'm not diminishing it, but really the response has been completely disproportionate, not only in terms of money, but even more so in terms of how quickly we're changing laws and diminishing civil liberties to enable this stuff. On the government side, on the counterterrorism side, so you get dispirited. Like you know, imagine you're discovering bad stuff that the biggest companies in the world are doing, and the most powerful government in the world is doing, and you feel that you're trying to fight that. It's very much a David or Goliath thing, and the more you know, the more impossible it seems. Meaning, not only is this whole mentality based on a certain kind of fatedness, predestination, right? But it's also like as you learn more about it, you start to see the logic of its development as completely inevitable and inexorable. Like there's nothing you can really do about it. So it seems like not only is it fated within the content of the system, it's also the system is fated to be. It is fated to exist, right? And so, you know, it's whatever. It got depressed. I got, I have anxiety, depression issues anyway, and obviously those were becoming exacerbated. I was becoming poor because I was trying to live as a freelance writer and freelance editor in New York City in the aughts when real estate was going through the roof, as it still is. I just felt more and more alien. And again, before Snowden, I would be talking to friends and people were totally sympathetic, would be totally sympathetic to my argument. But after a while, they'd be like, don't you think you're a little paranoid or you're worried too much or whatever. So Snowden was kind of a great thing for me in a variety of ways. Like I literally went to several parties when I saw people months later after the Snowden disclosures. And they said, I've been waiting to talk to you for, 7 months. Like you were talking about this stuff 5 years ago. And, I'm not patting myself on the back, but it was rewarding in the sense that finally I could talk about these issues and not sound like a crazy person, At a certain point around 2008, I was poor enough and crazy enough and depressed enough that I decided to put it aside in the sense that I would stop actively working on the writing and the note-taking. Obviously, I'm a junkie for developments in the field, so I stayed, paid attention to the news the entire time. When Snowden came out, obviously, I was very rekindled by that, and now I'm getting back more into it. I mean, I have a job and a half. I'm a working journalist. I have another day job. But my enthusiasm and also just sort of the clarity that Snowden's disclosures brought to some of my more inchoate assumptions were really helpful and galvanizing. And, it seems like a very newsy, ephemeral topic, but in my view, the more you know about it, the more you realize it's going to get just worse and worse until there's some kind of breaking point. And whether that's a collective wake-up call where the people finally rise up and demand that laws are passed that outlaw this stuff or some of this stuff, or there's going to be some real, social breakdown and the stuff will be applied by law enforcement to actual to rebels or dissidents, and that's another problem. This stuff we haven't even talked about.
Yeah, but we got to wrap it up there. But it's a good note to end on because all I want to say is I hope your book comes out before that crack happens, so I can help understand what's going on and let other people understand because you're very clear about these things, and so more power to you for sticking into the paranoid trenches and. Trying to think your way out of this. So thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric. Really a pleasure. Thank you.
Great. And I'll put links to some of Andrew's articles on the archive page and also on technosis.com so you can follow them. There's some articles in Art Forum and Freeze for you to check out. So until next week, keep your minds open.